Hello, everyone. So welcome to this week's W3C CTG meeting. So this week, we got Ori here to actually talk about different selective disclosure mechanisms. In the past few months, we have invited several experts in different areas to talk about different selective disclosure mechanisms. And I think it's a good idea to actually have another expert to kind of give us an overview about these different mechanisms and their trade-offs. So thank you, Ori, for taking the time to jump in here and then actually give a kind of overview presentation in regards to these different mechanisms and options. All right, before we get into it, just a couple of quick things. First of all, just a code of ethics and professional conduct reminder. Just want to make sure that everyone, respect each other's opinions. I think we have been doing that very, very well. So, but, you know, just as a kind of a ritual, I guess, a quick reminder at the beginning of the meeting. A quick reminder on the IP note, anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributions to CCG work guidance must be member of the CCG with full IPR agreement signed. Make sure you have a W3 account, and if you have any questions, or encounter any issues, feel free to just reach out to any of the co-chairs. Quick hold note, these meetings are being recorded and automatically transcribed. We have been publishing them probably within the next 24 hours to a couple of days. Sometimes we encounter some issues, technical issues. If you notice anything wrong, just let any of the co-chairs know and we'll try to fix it as soon as we can. We use GT chat to queue the speakers, and you can type in Q+ to add yourself to the queue, or Q- to remove. And you can do Q? To see who is in the queue. All right, introductions and reintroductions. If you're new to the community or you haven't been engaged in the community but want to re-engage, please feel free to just unmute and introduce yourself. Anyone? All right. Sorry?
Sure, yes. My name is
Jean.
Work at Spokio with Harrison, so just joining you all today. Thank you for having me.
Thank you,
work
Jean.
On the product team.
Thanks a lot. All right, anyone else new to the community? All right, announcements and reminders. Any new announcements? So a quick thing, so due to some personal reasons, Mike couldn't continue his turn as a co-chair for the W3C CCG. So Kimberly and I will work on sending out an email and then kind of shepherding the nomination and also the selection process for a co-chair. So usually we have three co-chairs for the W3C CCG, and just want to walk through that process to select a new one. And if anybody are interested, please feel free to just let us know. Any other announcements or reminders? And I think we have a cool hybrid open house event last week at II.bu. So thank you for all to attend. Kalia, please.
I don't know who's in London in this community, but I'm actually coming to London for like a day on my way to the IETF meeting. And there's an identity social at Newspeak House on the 2nd of November. So I'll put a link if folks are in London or know people in London that want to come.
Sounds good. Thank you. Sorry, any other announcements and reminders? Yeah, I was going to say that if you come across a cool presentation or discussion that happened at IIW, please feel free. Please actually just reach out to me. I kind of want to schedule some of these interesting talks and bring it to the CCG. All right. Any updates to the work items? Cool. Let's get to the main agenda. So today, again, we are very, very happy to and thank Ori to take the time. Ori is the CTO of TransU, one of the most active contributors to the CCG work items. And today, just want to thank him for taking the time to present on different selected disclosure mechanisms and also their different trade-offs. So, Ori, the floor is yours.
Awesome. Let me figure out how to screen share in Jitsi. Is this share video? Is that the keyword for this?
It's a third button. It's a...
There it is. All right.
Yeah, they should put some text, not just the icons, right?
That's all right. I'll figure it out. Every meeting software is different. Can you all see selective disclosure 2023?
Yes.
Awesome.
Thank you.
So this presentation is going to be kind of an overview of selective disclosure in general, and then comparing SDJWT to ECDSA, SD, but really like the kind of general purpose selective disclosure approach that works with data integrity proofs. It's my understanding that there's been previous presenters who've already commented on this, but I didn't attend that presentation, so I'm not sure if there's any details that I'm going to get wrong here, but you know, feel free to interrupt if you see something that's not correct or you're aware of something that I'm not aware of regarding the construction of the sort of selective disclosure primitives, which are shared in the data integrity proof approaches. All right, let's get started. So first, I'd like to kind of introduce the topic of, you know, what is selective disclosure? And, you know, in general, authors want to protect parts of documents using various technologies. Later, parts of the documents might need to be disclosed. How do we know that the disclosure is consistent with the original redacted document? And so, you know, one example of this would be, you know, government documents that are redacted and made available to the public. And so I've included a little snippet from the NPR website on the Mueller report. And it's an interesting example of selective disclosure. There's, you know, sections of the document that have only minor redactions, sections that have major redactions. And another interesting piece there is that, you know, they provide reasons for redactions. So, you know, one question that, you know, we might have as we think about building digital representations that can support selective disclosure is the reasoning around what was disclosed or not disclosed important to the sort of technical infrastructure we use to build selective disclosure capabilities. And then on the right-hand side, you can see the classic CIA triangle, confidentiality, integrity, availability. And selective disclosure fits into this sort of the triangle. It's about protecting confidentiality, protecting integrity. The availability piece is usually the thing that you sacrifice when you care about protecting confidentiality and integrity. But nonetheless, it's still an important part of the CIA triangle and information security in general. So I wanted to give just in the context of thinking about redaction, some examples from the declassification archive redaction codes. So if you're looking at government use cases, one of the things that you'll see is that there's these different reasons why information might not be made available to the public. And it could be that it's related to, you know, military plans or weapon systems. Could be foreign government information, like as in like our government wants to protect a foreign government that we have a positive relationship with, or maybe a not so positive relationship with. Could be related to intelligence activities, scientific information, weapons of mass destruction, and, you know, vulnerabilities. So there's lots of reasons why we don't share information. And sometimes it's important that while information be protected, we be able to disclose only the parts that are safe and keep sensitive the parts that are not safe to share in a wider audience. So I've taken the classic three role model that we're all familiar with from verifiable credentials, and I've expanded it to show some purple bubbles, which are emerge as you try and apply progressive disclosure, selective disclosure, data minimization. When you want to enable those capabilities, you end up having to modify parts of the three role models process. So as the issuer, before you can make a credential or a document with security, you have to think about what elements in the document should be disclosable and which elements should not be disclosable. And that's different than the traditional approach you might take, where you would say, you know, everything in the document's going to be disclosable. I'm going to sign the entire thing. So now you have to think about, okay, these fields are okay, but these fields, you know, we should be able to decide if we want to redact them or not. And I've given the name commitment, you know, to that, but, you know, different people use different words for that. And there's different software techniques that are used at that stage, where you're the issuer and you're starting to organize the information in the way that you need to in order to secure it. Another important part there is, like, as an issuer, you might be required to commit to disclosing, you know, in a mandatory manner, certain fields. So some fields in the document, every verifier that cares about that credential needs to be able to see them. And you don't want to give people the ability you don't even want to hint at the idea that they might not share that particular field. So, you know, when you're thinking about profiling verifiable credentials, one of the things you might think about is, aside from, you know, schemas or representations of the claims structure, you might also think about annotating those claims with redactability. You know, is this a field that a user should be able to control disclosure of or not? All right. And one other thing, you know, feel free to ask questions as we go through this. Like, this is a short presentation, so we'll definitely get to the end and we can have a conversation, but I don't mind taking questions as we go. So once you've gotten the issuers committed to the claims, they've created a structure, they've created the credential, and they've delivered the credential to the holder. At that point, the holder gets to decide, you know, what kind of information do I want to disclose? So, you know, the minimum that the holder might decide to do would be, I'm going to disclose only the mandatory fields. So I'm going to redact everything that I can. And that's going to support this concept of data minimization, which is really important in a lot of use cases. It protects the holder if the claims are about the holder. It protects, you know, the subject in the case the holder is acting in a guardianship role for the subject. So disclosure is an important consideration for the holder, and the disclosure is kind of a subset of what the issuer has allowed, right? So the issuer says you have to disclose your social security number, the holder won't have a choice. But if the issuer says you have the choice, you can disclose your social security number or not, now the holder can decide, you know, maybe I disclose my social security number when I'm talking to the government and otherwise I don't. And again, disclosure, the structure that you use to enable that feature kind of varies depending on the system that you're working in. And then the final piece is this verification piece. And that's always been a part of the three role model, but it's a little bit different in the case of selective disclosure. And that's because you have not just checking of a digital signature, you have reconstituting the issuer's claims, but modified by the holder's intended disclosures. So you end up having a data structure that is not as sort of safe as just a verified digital signature payload. There's been other stuff that has happened when you're looking at that final verification structure. And that's a place where implementation detail could cause, you know, harm. Like, I could implement the verification of selective disclosure incorrectly, and now a verifier is going to see claims that weren't actually committed to by the issuer or disclosed by the holder. It's easier to do that kind of thing with selective disclosure schemes because they don't just reveal signed bytes from the issuer and the holder. There's processing that has to happen in order to construct that final verified format. All right. I think that's it for this slide. So I wanted to just sort of try and make a apples to oranges comparison here between data integrity and SDJWT. And I fixed the elliptic curve and the hash algorithm so that you could see that those are in common. They're shared between both of them. And then I've included implementation details here for both of them as well, based on what I'm aware is available. And these implementation details could change, right? So they're not part of, they're not a fundamental property of the cryptography or the standards. They're choices that library developers have made to try and make the technology consumable and easy to use. So on the right-hand side, one of the things you'll see with SDJWT in particular, and I should say, you know, SDJWT is a OAuth working group adopted token format, builds on top of JSON Web Tokens and salted hashes. And it's pretty simple to implement. And we're going to look at the details of it, you know, in subsequent slides. One of the things that is interesting about the SDJWT implementations that I've seen is they tend to use YAML, which is another language entirely. And the reason they use YAML is because of that need for the issuer to mark things as disclosable. In JSON, you have key value pairs in objects, and the keys are always strings. So if I wanted to communicate with you all that only a certain key should be disclosed and not another key, I need a way to annotate the key in the key value pairs. And YAML provides a semantic tagging functionality that's very useful in that regard. On the left-hand side, you can see some of the building blocks behind data integrity proofs, in particular ECDSASD. And just speaking to that annotation, you know, value proposition, like how do you accomplish that? Data integrity proofs, the libraries that I've seen use JSON pointers to do that. So they point, you know, at the field that is intended to be mandatory to disclose or selective to disclose. And then there's some other building blocks that data integrity proofs use. One thing that both of these techniques have in common is they are media type specific. So they don't work over arbitrary content. They work over JSON or RDF, JSON-LD, which is RDF. So they're not like a general purpose cryptographic structure, like, you know, opaque bytes that you might sign and verify. So I'm summarizing here, you know, high level, some of the steps that you take during issuance. And so the first part is this sort of labeling claims that are disclosable. I mentioned that before. The issuer is going to have to think about what claims should be disclosable, what claims should not be disclosable. Data integrity proofs, you need to compute JSON pointers. SDJOT, you need to annotate some YAML. On the SDJOT side, you're going to walk the object tree in YAML. You're going to salt and hash any disclosable members. You're going to encode the result as JSON. Base64 URL, encode the JSON, sign a JWT like you normally would. And then you're going to append all of the disclosures that you computed. That's the issuance process. On the data integrity proof side, you're going to canonicalize, which is an RDF operation. That's going to produce RDF triples, which you're then going to blind because you don't want to accidentally disclose information that you don't intend to. You're going to generate a proof key, sign the mandatory to disclosed fields. There's some other details here around, like, you know, how do you construct this proof object? I'm going to kind of just hand wave over that for a second. Essentially, you're creating a proof key and signing each of the disclosable pieces and the mandatory pieces. And then you're encoding all of that information together in a bundle, which you're then including as an embedded JSON proof in the JSON LD. And that's going to allow in the future you to kind of take that bundle apart and disclose the parts that need to be disclosed only. So on the presentation side, you're going to have to derive the presented form for both of these. So in the SDJOT piece, you see you're going to walk the tree. You're going to filter the disclosures to the ones that the holder has indicated they want to disclose. So walking the disclosure tree is different than walking the issuer's commitment to the payload. The disclosure tree communicates which fields the holder intends to disclose, and walking that tree allows you to sort of figure out which parts of the disclosures you need to remove from the list. If you don't remove them, it'll be full disclosure. Every disclosure you choose not to give that is present in the payload is a redaction. And then you may need to demonstrate proof of possession over a private key for which the public key may have been committed by the issuer. That's the topic of confirmation or confidence or holder binding. So on the left-hand side, on the data integrity proof piece, you're going to unwrap that bundle that we created at the end of the issuance process, decode CBOR. You're going to compute a JSON LD frame from JSON pointers, apply the JSON LD frame, obtain the revealed document from the frame, filter the signatures to match the frame, re-encode the proof as CBOR, and then basically, you're just modifying the proof object that was embedded in the JSON LD document. So I've decoded, we have an implementation of the ECDSA SD approach, but it uses a different proof structure, which kind of shows you in kind of standards terminology the different components that go into the proof technique. But you can see in the centerpiece here, all of that JSON on the left-hand side gets smashed away when you encode this as CBOR. So the data integrity proofs format that you'll see, you know, in the specs just has proof value, and then it's a string of encoded bytes. Inside of that string of encoded bytes, you're going to have the commitment to the mandatory to disclose fields. You're going to have the HMAC keys, all of the signatures, that kind of thing. So it's just an alternate way of expressing the same kind of information. And the SDJOT side, you'll see the in the respec sort of rendered version of this, the red piece is the JWT header. The green piece is the JWT payload, which will contain weird-looking claims that are going to be present for any field that could be redacted. And then the signature in blue, and then the disclosures and key binding token in purple. And just to sort of show, you know, when you're parsing this kind of structure, the first thing you're going to do is separate apart the JWT and the disclosures. So the JWT is the issuer's signed representation with full redaction in place. And then the disclosures are each of the possible redacted fields unredacted. And you can see an example here of that, where you have this base64 URL encoded salt, this 18 literal, and then false. So 18 is the key and false is the value here. And, this array of, key value pairs and the salt has to be put back into the payload in order to get this nice verified looking result. And that's that purple verification process that I was talking about before. So when you're just looking at an SDJOT, you're kind of seeing it in this decomposed structure. And in order to get it back into a readable view, you have to process it. And that's a little bit different than the data integrity proof approach, where you're kind of always looking at the structure in a nice readable view, but there's all of this complexity in terms of ensuring the integrity of that readable view. So there's just different, very different design approaches here between the two. So this is my last slide. The main conclusions I think you should take away are, you know, both of these approaches, they show the verifier JSON that's computed from some intermediate representation. So you're looking at verified information that is always computed from some secured representation. Both approaches have performance issues that are tied to the input size and the percentage of disclosed claims. So that tree walking process that we talked about earlier, if the tree is really large, that takes a long time. And it's different, you know, the performance issues are, you know, they're very different depending on the approach that you take. And it's not just the CPU time to walk the issuance side tree or the presentation side tree. It's also the bytes used to represent the information in the secured formats. That's another concern that you should have regarding selective disclosure or proof techniques. Both approaches support the W3C JSON LD data model. SDJOT can secure arbitrary JSON data integrity proofs, as far as I'm aware, cannot secure arbitrary JSON without doing context injection. That's just so that you can get application NGODs that you could then process with the algorithm. There is a CBOR approaches for both of them. So in the case where you did want to get beyond JSON into more compact representations, there are CBOR approaches for both. There's SDCWT, which is basically just the CWT version of SDJWT. Doesn't do anything other than change out objects for maps and use CBOR instead of JSON. And then there's CBOR LD for data integrity, which compresses JSON LD using semantic dictionaries and sort of other details. Neither SDCWT or CBOR LD are standards track documents at this point, as far as I'm aware. I think that's basically it. So I'd love to take any questions you all have about selective disclosure or, you know, the topic. And if you don't have any questions, I'm also happy to have time back.
Thank you, Ori. So my first question is, like, in what situations would you use, like, SDJOT? Or is SDJOT more appropriate? In what situations would you use the data integrity proof?
Well, I would tend to use SDJOT for any case where I was trying to secure JSON. I would use data integrity proofs in cases where I was securing an RDF data model expressed as JSON LD. And you could use SDJOT to secure that data model. And if you're just securing JSON LD, I think SDJOT is actually a better way of securing JSON LD because it's actually securing the JSON representation. It's not performing this transformation to RDF. And that means it's sort of faster to secure JSON LD with SDJOT than it is to secure it with data integrity proofs, because you don't have to go through this intermediate representation, but you're still... Well, you have to go through an intermediate representation, but it's not a content type transformation. And in the case where, I guess one other important detail here is, like, what does the verifier learn at the end of the process? The verifier learns the same information in the case you've secured both of them and the proofs are both verified. So if the verifier learns the same thing, you know, we should ask, well, how expensive was it for the verifier to learn it? And then I think SDJOT is in general a more cost-effective way of securing JSON-LD claims. And then verifier learns the same information at the end of the day. That's just my personal view of this. Obviously, other folks may have different opinions on that. And there is some aesthetic preference that folks might have where they really like looking at JSON objects instead of compact encoded JSON web tokens. And for those folks, they might really prefer the data integrity proof piece because it uses embedded proofs in JSON, which are always readable. Of course, that also comes with security issues because you're looking at stuff that you haven't yet verified, and you might never verify it, and you might just trust it as the encoded representation. I think there was a hand raised, so David.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, if we replace with the BBS algorithm, is everything you said still true for the JSON-LD approach, or do things change?
So that's being debated right now in the Verifiable Credentials Working Group. As some of you know, I worked on the early versions of the BBS data integrity proof approach, and it did take the same kind of approach here. So it produces application end quads. The application end quads are then secured with the BBS algorithm, which has a different set of capabilities beyond just proving that a message was signed. You could reveal individual messages, and you can do link signatures and these other techniques. The Verifiable Credentials Working Group is still trying to figure out how to combine, how to take the approach that's being used in ECDSA and apply it to the BBS. And I think Greg is cued to answer, and I think he's probably the best position to comment on it. So go ahead, Greg.
Hi. Good overview, summarizing the bigger processes. So one thing that did happen with those SD primitives is they got rid of the framing stuff. So simpler step, okay? And so we go from describing what's mandatory, describing what we would like to disclose, that selected disclosure, just using JSON pointers, producing this list of statements, and that's what we feed into, whether it be the ECDSA approach, or we turn that into the stuff that we can feed into BBS. Because what we are talking about is, what is this list of statements? All our selected disclosures work with these lists. So that's what we're trying to make sure we can get into BBS. And by having some primitives, it made it easier to get things into BBS, and that's what I've updated that spec on. Note that there are other ways to get those lists, and so more ways potentially of using BBS besides just the one based on the primitives. Okay. There's JSON web proofs that are being proposed and things like that, but what things work from verifiable credentials to get down into them. But just wanted to point out that the steps have gotten a little simpler, and I think we are on track to be able to get stuff into BBS, and the BBS work is advancing nicely at the IETF, and we're going to be talking to NIST tomorrow about it at their crypto club. Thanks.
Greg?
Oops, sorry. Lower the hand.
So, Ori, just to kind of, is it fair to say that the major difference between the SDJOT and data integrity is the design side of things? Like, one is focused on, one started from JSON, the other one started from this link data RDF kind of approach. Is it fair to say that? Is that the major difference, or am I mischaracterizing something?
No, I think that's probably the major difference. I mean, you confirming different things. If you canonicalize information before you confirm it, you're confirming also that the canonicalization succeeded. But yeah, I think in general, like one is a way to secure RDF and the other is a way to secure JSON. Brian, you had your hands raised. You're an author of STChat. Welcome to comment here.
Yeah, I wanted to maybe mention or clarify a couple of things or just reiterate and then fill out of context with what you were saying, so I pulled myself off. But here I am. I did want to just strongly mention that the YAML that you mentioned is not at all a requirement of STChat in general. It just happens to be a technique that the reference implementation uses to mark up its data, input data, in order to produce the outputs, and choosing which claims to make selectively disposable or not is, you know, something that is going to have to be exposed at the API interface for whatever library it is. So YAML is not at all a requirement. It just worked well in the context of that particular reference implementation, which in turn is used to build examples. And so marking up in YAML, saying what you want out of the examples is a convenient way to do it. Maybe that was clear from what you said, but didn't want to overstate the requirement there.
I think it's worth repeating. So I did mention that the YAML piece of STJOT and the JSON pointer piece of data integrity, I think, are both technically their implementation details. Now, the JSON pointer piece might not be an implementation detail in data integrity now. It seems like things have changed in data integrity, and so JSON pointers are now like a mandatory portion of it. But in the context of STJOT, the YAML piece is like 100% an implementation detail, an API level consideration, not part of the standard.
And while I'm here, as far as the performance considerations, you're definitely correct that there's overhead in the number of disposable claims that are in there, but it's a fixed or linear increase in the overhead, because the only thing you're adding is a little bit of additional data around the encoding and a hash check. So there's not, performance implications of like doing additional asymmetric operations or anything like that when you're doing an STJOT issuance or verification. It's a relatively negligible additional processing overhead and a little bit.
Yeah,
it's still negligible space overhead.
Yep, I'm happy to comment more on the performance cost stuff if that's a topic of interest for folks. But I want to make sure I cover the questions folks have. I can't tell who's up first. David, I think you're up.
Yeah, just I think one of the things you didn't mention, Ori, is a limitation of the STJOT work is when you've got nested claims. You want to selectively disclose the bottom level. You can't actually hide the higher level properties, so they're always visible.
I don't think that's true.
It was in the draft I read. Brian, has it been improved upon now?
Well, so strictly speaking, you can hide nested content, but if you want to reveal something that's at a lower level, you're right, you do have to disclose the things that precede it in the tree down to it. That's sort of just how the algorithm works, but also you wouldn't have the context of where that exists in the structure, so revealing it without
So an example might be if you wanted to hide your where you lived, you might still have to, and you've got two addresses or something, you might still have to show address, town, and then what's hidden is the street, but you've still disclosed the higher level that it's an address and it's a town or something like that.
Yes. Yeah.
That's just generally true of all commitments the issuer might make as well. Like the process of organizing commitments in a way that supports the redactability of the holder is the responsibility of the issuer. If I build you a claim structure that forces you to disclose things, I can do that as an issuer. That's my choice and my right. Who's up? Greg, you're up.
I wanted to confirm that the higher level procedure of using the JSON pointers, which are standard, that did get put in as part of the standard or the part of the procedures, so it's standardized. So, I mean, one of the things is how much do we tell people how to do things? And so with the current selective disclosure, ECDSA stuff, you use JSON pointers, an array of JSON pointers, which tell you what parts of the JSON. This doesn't apply to, it doesn't matter if it's LD or not. And that tells you what statements you want to reveal, arbitrarily nested or whatever. And you use that same pointers on the holder side to say, what do you want to selectively disclose? So that's not an implementation decision anymore. That we put into the standard. So it's kind of nice. It works nice. No framing anymore of the JSON linked data framing stuff. So it's all kind of JSON processing for that selected document and things like that. Also, when you look at performance, I'm a networking guy, and so sometimes the first thing I think about it is the size of things. Okay, so you can look at it that from that point of view, but you can also look at it from cryptographic operations. Okay, and so that's where, as much as I love BBS, BBS does elliptic curves and pairings from a, you know, computational point of view, you're never going to beat something that has a signal signature in a bunch of hashes. Okay, so that's the SDJOT point of view. So make sure we understand that there's cryptographic operations and things like hashes are just super efficient. Then there's size things, right? So like a BBS signature from an issuer, super small, irregardless of the number of messages. So if you're more concerned about the network, that's one thing. If you're more concerned about how many times somebody has to process things. So just don't mix your apples and your oranges when you do look at these things. Okay. Cause yeah. I will admit that you're not going to beat hashing. Merkle trees are great for where they are applied.
Okay. Cool. Yeah, I totally agree. I would just sort of summarize, you know, what you said, like the curve operations are kind of expensive. On my understanding for ECDSA SD versus SDJWT, just, you know, putting the pairing-friendly curve stuff to the side for a second. ECDSA SD requires the proof key to be created, which then that's a key generation operation. You want to make sure that was fast, but also that it was random enough to be safe. And then you have signatures, multiple signatures. And that's different from the SDJOT approach where you have the holder's key that you're going to commit to, but you don't have a separate, like a new proof key per SDJOT generally. And you have one signature on the issuer disclosure, the issuance token. So I think in just comparing just ECDSA SD to SDJOT, the difference is ECDSA SD has multiple signatures and multiple rounds of HMAC, which is HMAC stuff is sort of similar to the salted hashes, you know, in terms of computation cost. And then on the SDJOT side, you've got a single signature and multiple rounds of salted hashes. So just from a crypto operations perspective, I don't think you're going to get a better performance from data integrity with multiple signatures ever based on that. But you might get other properties, and you might get a generic that you can reuse in the case of BBS.
Yeah. I mean, over in BBS land, we've been looking even at variations that may reduce the amount of computation on the holder. If you're looking at ECDSASD, you can say that the size of what the holder may have to send to the verifier cryptographically, that scales differently than in the BBS case or in the SDJOT case, because you've got individual signatures. You only have an overhead for what you reveal rather than overhead of what you don't reveal, which happens in the BBS case. So once again, I don't think that it's bad to have options.
Well, at some point, you know, hopefully we'll have a presentation here on unlinkability, and it'll be ECDSA, well, it'll be BBS data integrity proofs versus, you know, JSON web proofs, and we can compare kind of closer to apples on the unlinkability property. Like, the purpose of this presentation was just to focus on the selective disclosure piece.
Yes.
And so, you know, with BBS, you can get selective disclosure and unlinkability, and you can get that in support of multiple different envelope types, you know, like an RDF envelope or a JSON envelope or a CBOR envelope. But, you know, this comparison here is mostly just comparing JSON-LD and selective disclosure. Like, I didn't go into the details really around unlinkability at all here, because just another dimension. And also, it's very underspecified at this point. I'm sure you're going to fix that, Greg, though.
Yeah, we also need advice to the issuers on how to make sure we keep the unlinkability as we go along. So it's an important area, not needed in all cases, but if you're going to have it, you know, we got to make sure that you don't throw in something as mandatory, or you don't throw in something unintentionally that's going to be an identifier.
Yeah.
Sorry, Ori, Greg. If you don't mind, can you clarify what's the problem of unlinkability? I think some of us probably are not familiar with it. Yeah.
So this presentation's been on selective disclosure, which you can think about as redaction or, progressive disclosure, you know, revealing more information over time or removing information, you know, from a representation. There's this other topic called unlinkability, which is underspecified in a lot of cases and kind of a newer concept. It's embodied best in the privacy pass work at IETF. At least that's what I consider to be the best current version of it. There's work at IETF to make a general purpose sort of structure based on BBS for it. And then there's work to apply that general purpose structure to serialization formats like JSON and CBOR. And in general, the unlinkable property is like, if I go to a gas station and buy beer, and then I go to a different gas station and buy a different kind of alcohol. And I had to prove that I was of age in both of those cases. If those gas stations collude, they should not know that the same person bought alcohol at both places. They should know only that something proved that it was overage in both places. And that would be unlinkability. As in, the verifiers cannot link a particular presentation of a claim to another particular presentation of a claim. Now, like, there's lots of details inside of that, and there's cases where, like, it's important that you know, for example, like, if you're applying for drugs, you ask one doctor for hydrocodone, and then you ask another doctor for hydrocodone, and then you ask another one. Like, you kind of want some linkability for some scenarios there, but it is also an important property of building the highest level of privacy into the holder and the subject. And there's cases where you really want that property. And I think it's arguable that you should have a constitutional right to that level of privacy for certain use cases. But what those use cases are is that's contentious. You know, is it firearms? Is it drugs? Is it freedom of religion, freedom of speech, you know, other scenarios? That kind of area gets difficult, but what Greg said is true. Unlinkability is really easy to destroy. Anytime you present a stable correlatable identifier to multiple parties, you have created linkability. So you need to be presenting something that is indistinguishable from randomness kind of consistently, except for the claim being, you know, over 18 from a trusted issuer. And that's kind of hard to do. But there are ways to do it.
Thank you. The web advertising business is very good at grabbing pieces, separate pieces of information to fingerprint us and track us, especially with third-party cookies going away.
Yeah.
So we're almost able to kind of look at that as a counterexample and say, hey, do your cryptographic artifacts become the equivalent of unique identifiers?
Exactly.
And when you do a hash or something, or you do regular signatures, those things are very unique. It's only through these notions of zero knowledge proofs, which sounds scary, do we get some of these things where we can have this unlinkability. And BBS supports that. But once again, got to use it right. And that's why the more challenging part to me of this spec about BBS coming up is writing up the advice about how to preserve unlinkability and giving that advice to the issuers and the holders.
Yeah, I really like the thing that you said about tracking. Like, I think, we say selective disclosure and then we say redaction. They're kind of two sides of the same coin. You can think of unlinkability and tracking as being two sides of a different coin. And people don't like being tracked. It's hard to get rid of some of that tracking infrastructure once it gets widely deployed. Another example of harmful tracking, besides just advertising in general, would be the detected unwanting location trackers work at IETF, where, people who are fleeing domestic violence are having the sort of find my phone AirTag functionality turned against them. Tracking is a tool. All tools can be used to protect property rights or to assert dominance and to do other harm. Tools have to be used carefully. And when we build tools, we have to be thoughtful about how they will be misused. And the AirTag sort of find my phone, find my AirTag network thing, I would never have thought that would have been used in the way that it is been used. And it's really, really hard to put that back in the bag at this point. At the same time, if that technology becomes democratized and standardized and unlinkable, and still achieving its mission objectives, gets even harder to defend against. So you can be careful in trying to protect against tracking or trying to enable unlinkability. You don't accidentally create a unstoppable surveillance system that is non-observable, where you can't actually get into it and defend people from it.
Cool. Thanks for the clarification, both Ori and Greg. One last question. In regards to performance, is there a performance difference between using SDJob versus data integrity, or is the performance implications mostly on what kind of cryptography you use?
There's a performance difference at the application pre-processing layer. So with SDJob, you have to walk the object tree, and then you have to perform the hash out operations. So we'll call walking the object tree the application processing process piece, and we'll call the hash operations the cryptographic cost. The total performance for SDJot is all of the application processing cost plus all of the cryptographic operation cost. The same thing is true for data integrity. The data integrity algorithms are much more complicated than walking a JSON object tree. You have to convert JSON-LD to application NQuads. You do that by applying the RDF dataset canonicalization algorithm, that's exponential in the input size in the worst case and vulnerable to maliciously crafted payloads that can make it take as long as possible intentionally. That application processing piece is more expensive for data integrity. But what you get for it is commitment to the canonicalized information, which is slightly different than commitment to serialized bytes. Now, I would argue it's much safer to get committed to serialized bytes than it is to do the data integrity application processing piece. But I think you, without a doubt, you're paying a different application processing cost between these two. You're paying a higher application processing cost for data integrity because it's ensuring the information that's committed is consistent. And then you're also paying a higher cost for data integrity because you have per message signatures, which are curve operations and elliptic curves, and those are also expensive. So in general, both the application and cryptographic operations are more costly for the data integrity approach. And what you're getting for it is just a slightly higher confidence that the issuer's intention in RDF has been preserved. But all things being held equal and all issuer guidance being properly observed, the verifier is going to learn the exact same thing from SDJOT for way less computation. So, I mean, my preference, you know, in terms of performance here is probably very clear at this point. But, you know, you can have different, you could have arguments about the verification side versus the issuance side and whether the performance trade-offs are worth it in those contexts when you're doing very specific minimal disclosures. So there are scenarios where, you know, if you graph it out, a verifier might learn the same information, but the commitment to the issuance process would be higher for data integrity, but the verifier's process might be lower than SDJOT. You know, well, I don't think that would happen, but possibly that would happen if you really measure very, very different input payloads, very, very different output disclosures, and you compare the total cost of the application processing to the total cost of the cryptographic operations.
Thank you. That's very, very clear. Thanks a lot. All right. Any last questions? We have 1 minute. All right. Thanks again, Ori. And thanks everyone for making great insightful comments. I think this concludes today's CCG meeting. This is a great presentation, clarify a lot of questions I have in regards to different selective disclosure mechanisms. And so just want to say a big thanks again. All right. Bye.